despite a report showing some of its staff didn't have enhanced checks.
Urgent investigations are being carried out into whether government computers were used to post offensive comments online about the Hillsborough disaster. Changes were made to the tragedy's Wikipedia page. Steve Kelly's brother died in 1989. He wants those responsible dealt with.
You hope that the authorities within the governments will be able to find them, and let's hope that they act appropriately with that.
42-year-old Tanya Clarence has appeared in court, charged with murdering her three children in southwest London. She's been remanded in custody after her 3 and 4-year-olds were found dead on Tuesday. RBS has backed down over plans to give staff bonuses of up to double their salary. The taxpayer-backed bank dropped the idea because of government opposition. The US and Europe have agreed to work together to impose costs on Russia over the Ukraine crisis. They threatened tougher economic sanctions against Moscow, saying it hasn't stuck to a deal agreed last week. In sport, the final of Euro 2020 could be held at Wembley. FA says it will bid to host matches in the tournament, which will be shared across a number of European cities. And Beyoncé has made the front cover of Time magazine's 100 Most Influential People. The star beat Pope Francis and Barack Obama. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
Yes, it's Friday again, 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Friday Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news are UKIP councillor on Bradley Stoke Town Councillor Ben Walker, and Bristol's only Independence for Bristol councillor for Kings Weston, Jason Budd. Just in time. Jason arrives. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a wave of firebomb attacks over the last year is claimed by anarchist groups online. But is just the excuse the police needed to put Bristol's anti-fascists under surveillance? And how much real difference is there between the far left and the far right? We'll be asking Phil, anarchist Phil, after the 6 o'clock news. In Kiev government, the Kiev government sends the army in to break up checkpoints in between Donetsk and Kharkov, killing 5 protesters, we hear. But what would we do here in Britain if the far right took over the British police? And do the Kiev government really want peaceful elections next month? It's only just over a week and a half away. Also, the CIA's most expensive operation since the billions spent in the 1970s election fixing in Italy. Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan. We hear all about it from the CIA's most senior whistleblower ever, John Stockwell, who ran their operations to destabilise Angola. All that lot in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs up to 13. Sunshine and showers this weekend with some gusty winds early tomorrow. Highs next week of 13, roughly the same. Sunny spells and showers again towards the beginning of the week. Sunnier, though, towards the end of next week. Next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of May. Highs around 13 still. Sunshine and showers carrying on into May from April showers. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Ben Walker from Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor, and Jason Budd, an independent on Bristol City Council. Hello, both of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Thank you for having me again.
First of all, let's start with you, Ben. UKIP isn't so likely to get councillors on the City Council, but certainly in the European elections, it looks like you're going to do quite well. So just give us an idea. What is it that... I mean, what were you originally, a Conservative councillor?
Originally, yeah. I'm getting better now, though.
Okay. And what was it that convinced you to switch to UKIP? People elected you as a Conservative, didn't they? But you decided that you knew better, because that's a bit cheeky.
It was a bit cheeky, yeah. I think I've said this before. I mean, when I was elected to South Gloucestershire, so, you know, kind of the mirror image of Bristol City, I suppose. But I was elected as a Conservative, and it was a decision that I didn't take lightly, and I did actually speak to lots of the residents within my ward as well. Obviously not all of them, that would be disingenuous to say so, but you know, I did, and the reason I did is I just did not like what the Tory party had become, what they stood for. You know, I was sent out in 2011 to campaign for no top-down reforms of the NHS, and look at it now. You know, I was forced to lie as a grassroots kind of activist on the doorstep, and that didn't make
UKIP, and why not one of the other parties as a former Conservative?
I think UKIP, most of their sort of the core values and the things that they kind of stood for were sort of resonated with me. So kind of I fitted, really.
But we're also joined by Jason Budd from King's Weston. You're the only, I think, Independence for Bristol councillor so far on Bristol City Council. Mm. In a way, you're both coming from a similar point of view on disillusionment with the main parties. So why did you choose to go with the Independence for Bristol, and what do they stand for?
We're in slightly different situations, however there are similarities. In Bristol, the role of the council has changed because we have a directly elected mayor. So actually now, party politics in the city isn't so relevant to what we want to do and what we want from our city councillors. I think we've just heard a perfect description of what can happen when you vote for one of the parties and you get something other than what you voted for. With an independent, you really do get...
But wouldn't you agree
for.
With Ben in that, you know, you too seem disillusioned with the main parties?
I am disillusioned with the main parties. I would agree with that, certainly. I think it's partly a system fault. I think the voting system we have is wrong. I think that throws up a lot of problems. But there's a big difference between national and local government. And I think that distinction should be drawn. I don't... As an independent, I don't come from a position of disillusionment. I come from one from wanting to do the best for my community.
Give us an idea of what your professional background is. What experience do you bring to being a councillor?
I worked in small businesses. I worked in marketing and communications. I worked as a volunteer, as an event manager for different things. Prior to that, I was a Liberal Democrat. I was a member of the party,
like Lord Ferguson.
Mayor, yes.
I like to call him Lord Ferguson.
Okay, well, maybe. Other people call him different things. That's a new one on me. Yes, like him. I mean, I only became a Liberal Democrat in about 2010, and not in a dissimilar way to my UKIP counterpart here. Became disillusioned when I wasn't in office.
Okay, well, let's pin you down, both of you, on some of the news stories this week. To start with, one of the things that shocked me most, and I think really should, you know, get more coverage, is the news that Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs are set to sell taxpayers' financial data for profit. New legislation would allow HMRC to, this is according to The Guardian, end of last week, to release anonymised tax data to third parties, including companies, researchers and public bodies where there is a public benefit. That's what they say anyway. The financial personal data of millions of taxpayers could be sold to private firms under laws being drawn up by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. Despite fears that it would jeopardise the principle of taxpayer confidentiality, the legislation would allow HMRC to release anonymised tax data to third parties, including companies, researchers and public bodies, as they've said there. Now, this comes hot on the heels, doesn't it, of what we've heard Ben Walker, UKIP councillor up in Bradley Stoke, to do with the National Health Service, public record, private records. Now, when we do these deals with the government, we have a guarantee, supposedly, an expectation that the information that we give them will be confidential. Now we're hearing tax data is also going to be sold, albeit anonymised. Although, of course, you know, for some people will say it's impossible to anonymise this information. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's outrageous, to be quite frank with you. It's you know, if this is the best that the government can come up with to think of ways to generate additional revenue, this is quite shocking. I mean, this is already going on with companies to companies. You know, and you forever buy your telephone number, and then you're still getting calls off of companies that you've never even heard of, you've never even engaged with, and I think for the government to go down this line and actually sort of, you know, jump on the boat and start selling details in this fashion, I just think this is disgraceful.
But I mean, what they're saying, isn't it, to HMRC is you're raising taxes, but you also have to generate new income streams, and this is just one of them. I mean, they're looking at the data that they hold and they're saying to these government departments, look guys, unless you can generate some revenue, I bet you this is what's going on behind the scenes. We're going to privatise you.
I mean, that's always the big stick that Tories like to wag, isn't it? And I think you're absolutely right. I think that probably is in the background, and that's the threat.
Jason, what are your thoughts on this one, coming particularly, as I said before, hot on the heels of the threats to sell off private medical data?
it's extremely worrying. Outrageous is not a bad word. There is this word that anonymized data. I think anyone who's worked with big blocks of data like that knows there is no such thing, and it's very worrying that if people give out that kind of data, things can be traced. I'm actually a bit concerned about what the motive is here, because we talk about
it's money.
It is money. But talking about taking off, but how much money were you talking? Because is there a cost-benefit analysis on what this decision is being made? I don't know. I don't think any amount of money is worth the risk to citizens when dealing with what should be the most trustworthy of bodies, Her Majesty Revenue Customs. As with David Davis MP, it's borderline insane.
And also, of course, HMRC haven't been very good at collecting money from certain multinational corporations who
it's kind of
like
the other
to sort
end of the scale, isn't it?
And one of the paragraphs here is particularly worrying. HMRC's checkered record on data is likely to come under scrutiny given historical scandals involving the loss of personal information of about 25 million child benefit claimants and 15,000 bank customers. So, you know, the idea that they're guaranteeing us that this is all going to be anonymous, well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is one way for the government to be raising money. Why on earth are they doing this? They're saying, of course, to HMRC is you've got to find new income streams.
Well, I think I agree with all of that, Tony, but let me just make this point. In Norway, since the Second World War, everybody's tax returns have been public property. Always. Not just for those running for public office, everybody. So everybody can see exactly what everybody's worth and exactly how much tax everybody pays.
So they can't hide money in shell companies in Norway? Are you sure about that?
If you do, you're breaking the Norwegian law.
What are your thoughts about that, you two? Do you think there's a case for it? Jason first?
I think as a member of the public, you have a right to privacy, and the notion that you would have to publish personal accounts would be quite troubling. Obviously, companies and organisations and things like that, and indeed if you hold public office, but as a member of the public now, I wouldn't want... I believe in liberty under law. No.
I would agree with that. I mean, I'm interested about the Norway thing, though. I mean, maybe that's because of the size of population, it's manageable. I don't know. I mean,
it's the way they think about it. And don't forget, from an economic point of view, if I'm making a decision to buy or sell or do some training or apply for a job, I need price information, don't I? Who's paid what? Yeah. Is that price information? So when you go to the shop, you need to see what the price of something is. Now, when we're talking about what people are paid, we need to know what everybody's paid if we're all going to have the information we need to make decisions about what we're going to do with our lives. And that's been the position in Norway since the Second World War.
Listen, it sounds slightly disingenuous, to be honest with you, because there are ways of doing market analysis on salaries and market cost pricing at the moment.
And I would suggest, Martin, that there are some people in Norway, naughty people in Norway, who keep their, maybe a private company, their director of a private company in Luxembourg or the Isle of Man, which is notorious for keeping dodgy companies, where the information about that company is not available to the general public. We had that actually, an empty building in Stokes Croft we found was owned by a bunch of people in Hong Kong by a company that was registered in the Isle of Man, owned this empty building in Stokes Croft. So that's the sort of thing that Norwegians can do too.
But the Norwegians are outside the EU, so they can do what they like, and that's their decision. That was their decision, and of course the way they run things in these Scandinavian social democracies is that you are going to be transparent in what you do. And you were all, you know, we're all going, the kids are all going to go to the same schools, everybody's going to have the same rules on taxes, and so on.
So do you think GCHQ were looking at Norway and thinking, if they can do that, well, why can't we pry into everyone's private?
What's happening here is this data is going to be sold for private profit to various people. Whereas what's in Norway, it's absolutely clear everybody's tax returns are there available. They're online now. They never used to be online, but they're now online. So when you meet somebody, say we're having a debate like this, chaps, I can say, well, Justin, I know exactly how much you're worth. Bang.
Justin's starting to sweat.
No, but do you see what I mean? But that does actually create a bottom line. So when if you think of all the corruption that you've seen in some countries in the world, when people stand for office, there's no hiding.
Martin, there's no doubt there is an argument for that, but there's been no public debate about this in Britain. There's been no discussion.
That I understand. This is just a silly way to try and raise money.
Okay. UKIP election posters. Nigel Farage defends the racist, in inverted commas, campaign, anti-immigration campaign ahead of the European elections. The UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage defended his party's controversial election campaign ahead of the mayor elections after posters were dubbed racist. The economics spokesperson Stephen Wolfe announced the campaign on Twitter on Sunday and said the giant posters would be coming to you soon. Well, Ben, what we've got here is a poster saying who really runs this country. 25% of our laws are now made in Brussels. Another poster.
75.
Sorry, yes, you're absolutely right, 75%. And then another one with a finger pointing out of the poster saying 26 million people in Europe are looking for work and whose jobs are they after? And another one saying EU policy at work with a picture of someone with a cross leg sitting by the pavement with a begging bowl out. So anyway, I mean, people are saying that these actually what's going on here is an attempt to be a bit racist, Ben.
Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, the word racist is obviously a very important one, but I can't help but feel that it's used against UKIP too frequently, and it's kind of used by people when they've lost the argument, and it's the only thing that they can then get to stick. These posters aren't racist, and I think you made an important point off of air, Tony. You know, they're actually saying the things that people are thinking, yet don't say. And that's kind of what UKIP have been doing. You know, we've been driving the debate in this country for the last year or so, probably even more than that. And we're forcing parties to sort of, you know, make calls on stuff that they never even, wasn't even on their radar beforehand. And I think it's a good place to be. And this poster campaign is just another way of saying the things that people are thinking and obviously just trying to get more support for our party as we move forward.
Well, points have been made this week. One of the most, the hardest really, is that you know, it's actually not accurate what these posters are saying. The one in the middle says 26 million people in Europe are looking for work and whose jobs are they after? Well, around about 2 million of those people are actually here in Britain already.
I mean, that's true, but obviously the 26 million figure, that's true as well. There are 26 million people in Europe looking for work. I mean, if you look at Europe, the European Union as a whole, you know, and this is one that they tried to catch Nigel Farage at in the recent debates, there are 485 million people who have free access to come to this country. Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute they all will, but they can, you know, and
as you can go abroad.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course, the same argument applies.
Well, Jason's making an important point there: is that actually it's an equal situation. Yeah. People can come here and get jobs,
but
But
what's
Ben.
Not equal about that is when you look at, for instance, I mean, Romania is the hot topic at the moment. But if you look at the minimum wage here, and then you compare the minimum wage to Romania, they are paid 9 times less than someone claiming the minimum wage here. So that, in my mind, is not equal.
What are your thoughts, Jason? Romanians, no, I think. But actually, to come to the point of the poster, sorry, I don't believe they're racist. I think racist is sometimes a word that is used in a too simplistic way. They might be xenophobic, perhaps. I don't think, however, that these are things that people are just really thinking. I think this is playing on people's anxieties, and that's what these posters are affecting.
But it's not an anxiety if you haven't got a job or if you're threatened.
Not.
You know, and actually, what we're being constantly told is, you know, people are going to be encouraged to get work. Well, actually, there's nowhere near enough jobs to go around. We know that. I mean, ever since the 1980s, mm-hmm. there's not been full employment. People are trying to get work, but they can't. You're not all those people who are unemployed. There aren't the jobs for them.
But with the employment situation we have within the UK, yes, we have EU immigration, and indeed many of the jobs are taken by EU people who've come to this country to work. What would be the situation if they weren't there? I mean, people can apply for these jobs as well. They're not being discriminated against in favour of EU workers. It's a free market for people to employ people, and indeed the people as in from Romania are coming here for a better life and plugging holes in our employment gaps that we have, that we need to run society.
But surely, I mean, the whole point of it is just to drive down wages, pay and conditions. I mean, it's the big business people that want this economic migration.
Well, this is where that point about the minimum wage would come in, and that's ways that we can protect the general public.
But the minimum wage isn't a living wage.
That's a very good point.
This is the trouble.
That's a very good point. point. And I would like to see a living wage. I would like to see the income tax threshold risen further than what it has been by national government. And that would be a way of further protecting people from exploitation in the ways that you say. But it's to throw the baby out with the bathwater to put the battlements up around the country. Our economy would suffer if we did that.
Martin, what about these posters? Are they racist?
Well, I think we're discussing how accurate they are. I think that's the real issue, isn't it? I mean, how accurate are the allegations? I think Nigel Farage himself said that there's no way that people who are already here can be sent home. He's already accepted that. I think if you were to say that we're not going to have anybody coming in from Romania, and of course Ukraine, if they became part of the EU, yep. 47 million Ukrainians might be turning up here asking for jobs as well. But and I think Nigel Farage was actually very, very strong about that when he was debating with Nick Clegg, and he was pointing out that we're being dragged to war by the EU and NATO here, and he also pointed out that the Syrian chemical weapons attack wasn't carried out by the rebel by Assad, but by the rebels. Interesting stuff. Because we're now, the debates are now opening up, aren't they?
Contentious stuff as well.
Contentious, but interesting. And worth saying, because I happen to believe he's right about those things. Now, the fact is, you see, if you do stop further people coming in, that's against EU basic law. Yeah. It is. So you're basically saying, we're leaving the EU. Now, if you leave the EU, Norway's outside the EU, but they pay more per head into the EU budget than we do.
Yep.
Because if you leave the EU, you've then got to face a tariff wall for your exports into the EU. That's what the EU is all about. Now, you can get out of that tariff on your exports if you pay into the EU budget, and the Norwegians have negotiated to pay into the EU budget. They pay more per head into that budget than we do, and they don't get anything spent on them in Norway.
They also have no one sat at the
table. Nobody decides. But from the Norwegian point of view, they see that as they're prepared to go down that road because they really do want to be independent of the EU, so they can do things like having everybody's tax returns online, yeah, and so on. Because they've got a very strong socialist tradition in Norway, mm-hmm, which they don't want watered down by what they see as EU big business policy.
But Martin, so Can we come back to the business about racism and immigration? Because for a lot of people, when they see people saying, well, look, hang on, this immigration is wrong, and you get into the sort of Mosleyite attitude, old-fashioned ideas of, actually, these people are bad, we don't want them here.
Well, I think we can draw a distinction between having a robust debate about immigration and its, mm-hmm, effect on wage levels and other things of that sort, and racism. And I think that Nigel Farage has actually been quite good and strong about saying that we're not interested in... I mean, they've had to remove one of their candidates this week because he came out with a load of nonsense.
Yeah.
And he's basically embarrassing his own party. And I think I'm willing to accept UKIP as part of the political structure in this country, provided that... I'm English, not even Scottish or Irish or Welsh, but I hate racism. It's part of my English identity.
Can I just leave the final word to you then, Ben? What do you think that the poster campaign's going to work?
I think it already has.
You've got it printed. You've got your posters printed on the major newspapers free.
This is the thing. I mean, you know, UKIP are in quite a sort of strange position because it seems no matter what sort of publicity that gets kicked up by mainstream media, it always tends to work in our favour. And I don't quite understand why that's happening, but it is. So do I think it's worked? Yeah, I do. And but I think it'll continue to do
so.
I've
observed over the last couple of weeks, it seems like all of the bad stories about UKIP have been being saved up by the Conservatives. Mm. All year just to be rolled out before the election, but anyway,
and they just don't stick anymore.
Bristol North West MP could be investigated over a cash donation. This is Charlotte Leslie on our ITV West at the end of last week. Charlotte Leslie is apologising in Parliament earlier this month because she could face an investigation over her failure to declare cash donations to her local party. Charlotte Leslie, Conservative member for Bristol North West, apologised to the House of Commons for failing to comply with the rules, but now a letter of complaint has been made to Westminster Standards Watchdog. Ms Leslie asked questions about the proposed Seven barrage, but failed to mention that her local party had received £17,000 from the boss of the Bristol Port Company, who opposes it. Now, this is sort of echoes of cash for questions here, Jason. And also, of course, the Bristol Port Company has been in the news recently, having, it seems, got a very, very nice deal to take the freehold of the land off of the City Council, off of Lord Ferguson.
Do you treat the issue at hand at the moment? I don't actually know the details of this other than what's been in the press. It's very troubling because, if nothing else, it does nothing good for people's perception of MPs in Parliament coming after we are, after a very damaging expenses scandal.
But isn't this the way it works? Someone will pay the party a bunch of money, and the party then does what that person wants.
And that, it rooted, there's a problem with how we fund political parties in this country. We are a system built around it being on donation and membership basis, which is vulnerable to that kind of thing.
If someone coming in with a fresh point of view as an independent, how would you like to see party funding work?
I think there's some basis for what was the report that came out within this parliament of some national basic baseline funding, as happens with the opposition MPs in parliament with what's called short money, which allows them to have a functioning opposition within Parliament, even though that they don't have the benefit of being within government, and
so
the revenue benefit that
so that
brings.
A party should get state money or what?
To an extent, yeah. Based on the amount of votes that you got at the last election, yeah. I think that was the math that it worked out on last time. I'm not saying that it should be the sum total of it, but when we have private money like this involved, and you're never going to, I don't think you can ever keep private money out of politics, actually. I don't think that's ever going to happen. What you can do is make it ever more transparent. And what's very worrying here is that that transparency hasn't been in place. I mean, in terms of this issue, it is a major issue within the constituency that I would expect the MP to be asking questions on. So that's, there's a very valid point there. But the trace back of this money should have been apparent from the start, and I think it's nothing but regrettable.
Well, let's just make clear, this is an investigation. The evidence is being presented as an accusation, and we'll see what happens. But Ben, what are your thoughts about political funding? So it seems on the surface of this that money has simply been paid for Charlotte Leslie to be asking questions for the Bristol Port Company.
Yeah, it does. And I I'm a little bit upset about that, because actually, for Charlotte, I actually rate her as an MP. I think she's a hard-working constituency MP. This is awkward, and I think it kind of goes to the core of all the issues that we have at the moment, the rise of UKIP, the thirst for independence. There is such unrest and discontent with the political establishment. It's untrue, and this is why, the fact is, she has been outspoken speaking against a potential barrage going in there, which I personally think would be a good idea and should be investigated, for wealth and jobs, you name it. It's got everything as a project. But she's been outspoken and spoken against it, and funnily enough, she's been getting money to do so. And it is wrong. I mean, when it comes to the state funding of political parties, I understand the argument for that. I'm not so sure I feel quite comfortable about it. But what seems to be missing with all political parties, or all the mainstream ones that we have now, is the morals. They have no morals. It doesn't really matter where you get your money from. We all know that everyone's got their own ideas and remits. That's kind of what you buy into when you vote for a party. But it does kind of seem they've got no morals, and they'll do what they want and get money from where they want. And it's just quite wrong.
Questions being asked about £60,000 from the EU going to Nigel Farage's account at the moment, isn't there? And whether that's been spent on national party politics rather than the EU.
Yeah, well, that isn't a private business. That's as part of his entitlement as an MEP. But let's just probe a little bit more. What are your thoughts about the barrage, the rights and wrongs of it? Because quite clearly, it's going to be a potential problem for the Bristol Port Company. Mm. There's a barrage stopping ships coming in and out of the port. So you can see why they would be lobbying for it.
But I'm a layman when it comes to this sort of stuff, and I'm certainly no expert. But from what I understand, the technology is there, so the two could kind of work, harmonious and get on with each other, and both would function effectively. And I think there has to be some work done around the investigation and the possibility of having this. I mean, if you had a barrage there, just think of the jobs that's going to create, and the wealth it's going to create for the city and the neighbouring councils. And not only that, as a source of energy production, that is immense.
Well, we've got, isn't it, the biggest tidal reach in the world, or the second biggest? Enormous,
This is a very
at the moment it's mud.
Indeed, this is a very long-running discussion about this. I think it goes back decades, actually, and there have been lots of studies on it. Mm. I'm a layman as well, and I'm a local boy, so I know that it's been going as long as I've been there. I think there is an argument around the damage it might have to ecology, not only what it would do to the port, which is a major employer. I would like to see some kind of, not necessarily a compromise position, but I would have thought there is some way that we can do both. I believe tidal lagoons are one of those options where it isn't perhaps such a barrage as such, but it allows certain amounts of the Severn to be used for that tidal generation while still allowing free sea bearing.
Okay, Martin, what about the substantive point here, which is to do with party funding? £17,000 from the Bristol Port Company.
Funding of politics is a huge problem all over the world. I mean, the US Supreme Court has just decided that any amount of money can be spent on political campaigns, and it doesn't have to be even accounted for. You don't even have to explain what you're doing. In the Scandinavian countries like Norway, state-funded political parties have been there since the Second World War, and of course PR has been there since the Second World War, which I'm very much in favour of. In fact, I'm in favour of PR and state-funded political parties. Parties, because I like Norway. I think they get most things right.
I think we got that.
Okay, on to another story. Squalor. Why did, this is the Bristol Post this week, why did communication lines not work? City councillors demanded to know why there was a communication breakdown between police and the council over a tenant living in extreme squalor. Conservative Richard Eddy quizzed officials at the Housing Management Board about conditions for Noel West House, revealed by the Bristol Post back in February. A 37-year-old father, who can't be named for legal reasons, admitted in court that he had allowed his children to live in appalling conditions because his partner had left him and it was her job to do the cleaning. Her job, in inverted commas, I stress. Mr. Eddy first brought the case to the council's attention, to the board's attention, when he found out that the officials from the property is council owned. He'd been trying to find out how the young children were allowed to live in the messy home with their father for so long. Now, this whole element, Jason, of destitution, I think, is an increasing problem here in Britain. We've got the food banks and people basically finding it very, very difficult to look after themselves. I mean, I've no idea who this chap is. They're not telling us, but it certainly sounds as if you know, this place was pretty awful.
It sounds horrible, and obviously my heart breaks, bleeding heart liberal, for the children involved.
Well, just to say that when police arrived at the home, they discovered three neglected children, all aged under 12, who were living amongst empty milk cartons, rotting food and broken glass. Despite the conditions described as appalling by the judge, a dad was spared prison for neglecting the children and given a suspended sentence. But I mean, this sounds to me not so much of a criminal matter, but a matter of social care,
yeah,
and poverty.
I think you're completely right there, and I'd like to widen the debate, and I hope Richard would agree, Councillor Eddy would agree, to widen the discussion about, if this was the case, what are the schools involved, what are the doctors involved, you know, have these children had their inoculations and things like that. You know, I would have thought there had been other ways that society had failed these children, actually, and the rights and welfare of the father doing what he did. We have to look at ways that children can be protected from living in what are appalling conditions that simply shouldn't be in place.
So,
in this country.
Are you witnessing any of this sort of thing in King's Weston? Is it, you know,
nothing?
What? No,
is this extreme? No, God, no.
What about you, Ben?
Well, am I witnessing it?
Yeah.
I mean, I've got my partner works in a school, and I won't say which one anyway. But you do get murmurs of all this sort of stuff all of the time, and it is really worrying. And it has got worse in the last couple of years. You know, with the growth of food banks, you know, the welfare state under scrutiny and being changed. I think it is a problem on the rise. But it's as you just said. I mean, there are so many statutory bodies here and schools and stuff. You know, this story doesn't say a lot, but it seems that there's no questions being asked by anybody, and that's worrying in itself.
But for your partner, I mean, is she in this position sometimes where she's wondering, well, should I do something or should I not?
Very much so, and the bureaucracy that's attached to doing something is immense, and it's almost like, you know, you're put off of doing something or saying something, and that's not a good place to be either.
So for the teacher, this may be one of the first points of contact, one of the most obvious places where you know, a family that's in trouble like this is going to come into contact with officials.
Yep.
Of any sort.
Absolutely, you know, that they are the first people, and really the first line of defence almost, because it's not likely that social workers are going to pick up on this, you know, unless something dreadful happens. But yeah, you know, what has the school done? I mean, are the kids even going to school? I don't know. Does
well,
it
that's
say?
It. I mean,
you presume so, but
if the housing is in that condition, I can't imagine that the children are turning up in particularly clean clothes or state of repair, and I would have thought that would have raised the red flags it needed to trigger then social services getting involved. And schools aren't a branch of social services, but they are part of the mechanisms we have in societies to alert where this type of problem is.
Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford Economist, what are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, it does seem that there's a rise in this kind of thing, as the Conservatives have themselves have said, this government, the coalition, they're part of the coalition anyway, that they actually want to see an end to the welfare state ultimately, so these people would be not being looked after at all.
I mean, the big question about the welfare state, let's put that on one side for a minute. Obviously, I don't agree with the government's policies on the welfare state. I would just point out that I think there's something like several hundred, 200 or something like that, children every year in Britain are killed by their carers. Sure. Of that 200, only a minority were previously known to social services. Mm. That is the scale of the problem. Whenever something really awful happens, we all tear our hair out and go, isn't this awful, baby pee and all the rest of it? But this is actually going on all the time. And, you know, if you really want to intervene in the lives of people in this kind of underclass, if you want to call it that, you've got to spend money. You've got to get your chequebooks out, and you've got to be serious.
Martin, they can't spend money. There is no money.
It's more than spending money.
Well, it is more than spending money. But, and of course, all of the agencies concerned have got to consider what went wrong in this particular case. But don't forget that the seriousness of the problem. Many of the children who die are not previously known to social services, because of course people are pretty good at hiding this stuff. And I mean, one of the things they do in Norway and other social democratic countries is they have a very, very strong nursery school system. Everybody goes to nursery age 3. They don't try and teach them to read till age 7. And of course that means you've got a lot of, you can monitor what's happening from a very early age with children.
I think there's also something about society to be said here as well, that, you know, what are the neighbours doing? I can't, you know, where's the rest of the family?
It's difficult to know if neighbours are actually even interacting.
I'm thinking out loud here, but it does say something about the kind of social cohesion that we live very atomised lives, that this situation could have taken place in a street full of other families and no one
notices.
Either you or no one had the withdrawal to notify the people.
Well, maybe someone will be taking.
Somebody has noticed it.
Maybe somebody.
Too late.
Maybe someone will be listening to our man from the Norwegian embassy. Who knows? anyway, on the subject of housing, councils. This is the front page of this week's Inside Housing. Have done a special investigation. Councils bar 113,000 people from our waiting lists, and this is an exclusive. They say 126 English local authorities are using their new powers to reduce waiting lists. More than 100,000 people each week. Sorry, no, more than 100,000 people have been struck off or denied access to waiting lists since councils were given new powers to prevent people from applying for social housing. Exclusive research by Inside Housing found 126 English local authorities have used powers granted by the Localism Act to change their allocation policies. 77 councils that provided detailed figures informed 113,000 people that they no longer qualify for social housing for reasons including a lack of connection to the local area and antisocial behaviour. Using powers under the Localism Act, councils have since June 2012 bumped an average of nearly a third of applicants off their social housing waiting list. Well, this is very easy for councils, Jason Budd, isn't it, now? Because they can say, oh, our waiting lists are going down and down the whole time.
Well, the waiting lists are huge, and that's a major problem outside of
this.
We've
got around about 15,000 people on the list, up, but that's before this new legislation.
I'm always in favour of reviewing and reforming the procedures that are in place. If this is being done punitively and really to just chase the numbers down, then that would be very concerning. However, I'm quite willing to ask questions about, you mentioned, what was the phrase, social... behaviours
informing antisocial behaviour.
Antisocial behaviour, that's it. I mean, I think if you've been found guilty of committing severe antisocial behaviour, that does draw into question your application to certain things like this. That's part of a wider social contract that we have. Yes, I think I'm comfortable with that. I don't know the details, but if this is just being done to chase the numbers down, that's appalling. Of course, what we need is more social housing. That's the real issue.
Okay, and how are we going to do it? How are we going to get it in Bristol?
One of the ways that we could get it in Bristol is by the example of the port. The money that the rights and wrongs of it outside of that, and the money raised from it could be used as seed capital to generate more social housing within the city, used by not for housing associations, but, you know, council properties built for the first time. I think we've only built 20 in the last year or something like that. And that's a historical problem as to how our views of what is a state property and council properties have changed to social housing and housing associations. But I think there is, you know, I'm part of Generation Rent. I don't have, I'm not a social tenant, but I'm one of those people who are at the other side of the baby boom, so I'm looking at a life of renting. And so I'm very aware of what the property situation is.
So are you one of those people in the situation that if you lose your employment, then you could be out on your ear?
I think, I have the right to apply for a certain amount of housing benefit, and you know, there would be social benefits that would help me. But I the prospect of property ownership is not something that I have in the same way that my parents did.
Okay, Ben Walker, UKIP councillor in Bradley Stoke. What are your thoughts on this particular issue of councils across the country now saying, actually bringing the official homeless figures down or waiting lists down by actually barring people from the lists, including what Jason was talking about there for reasons of antisocial behaviour. Sorry, mate, you're not allowed on the housing list.
Yeah. I'm not sure I feel too comfortable about that, because if you don't house that person, then where are they going to go? Okay, they might have done something wrong, but, you know, these people have got to be housed.
I mean, for example, people coming out of prison potentially might be considered someone
who's...
Absolutely,
what do you do? I mean,
someone coming out of prison has served their term and are legally then a free citizen, but if someone is, you know, committing serious antisocial...
But where would they go? Prison? Because they're full as well.
Emergency housing. And so social housing until their conduct improves.
Anyway, Ben, I just want to pin you down a little bit on what you think can be done about housing. Everybody agrees there's not enough social housing, whether that be housing associations or councils, for people that really need it, are desperate in one way or another.
Well, I'm glad this debate's come up, because it must have been over the last year I've seen an increase in this type of thing in my ward work. I mean, what's very common now is that people are sofa surfing, so they're spending a couple of nights at a friend's, then they're at their mum's or something like that, and they're moving around. And it seems, I can't speak for every authority, but for South Gloucestershire, they're almost happy with that. And I think that is outrageous, and they are using these new powers to adjust their figures and make them look good. What could be done about it? Well, we all know it is more social housing. How we get it? Well, who knows? I mean, that's big business and big builders who are kind of in charge of that, not so much the government.
Well, there's a lot of houses being built up on the old Filton airfield site, aren't there?
Oh,
what
wow.
are your what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that shouldn't happen. And that shouldn't happen for a number of different reasons, not so much for social housing. I mean, that's... You're talking about the introduction of... It's around about 6,000 houses in an area which is already stricken with traffic in the morning. The infrastructure just isn't there. It already seems with this development in itself, they haven't learned the lessons from Bradley Stoke. No infrastructure's going in first.
Sure.
They've built roads with no pavements, yet they're trying to push a bus service, so people are expected to get on the bus with no bus stops and nowhere to walk. It's an incredible situation, and yet they're doing it all again. And the reason they're doing it all again is literally as a way of raising revenue. So South Gloucestershire just want to get that council tax in.
We do need more properties there, so I'm not against the properties being there, but the key word that you use is infrastructure, and that's what's not in place. And this is a very key issue for my ward, because one of the main artery routes that go through there will be coming down from there, and we already have traffic problems from that. And if there isn't the infrastructure in place to cope with a rise in the population, then there is going to be a social impact fallout.
But I mean,
that
this
can
is
be mitigated.
Listen, folks, sorry, but this is the free market. Bristol, BAE Systems. BAE Systems have the absolute right to sell that land.
Yes,
now,
I agree.
It was public land until they were privatised, but the Filton Airfield. Now they can sell that to whoever they want. They've just said, well, who's the highest bidder? And the big house builders have come along and said, we want it.
You know where the real problem was? That airport should have been the Bristol National Airport and not the Lowell's Gate shed in a field out there. That's a different issue for a past government. But it is the private market, we do need more houses, I'm happy for more houses to be built, but the infrastructure does need to be in place, and the infrastructure is the counterpoint of the free market. Road building isn't determined by, you know, we don't pay toll roads, you know, that is part of what the state does, and we need greater integration and interaction. It's actually part of the breakup of Avon, actually, I think, is the route here. This is a cross-border issue, just of the cliff edge between the borders of what used to be within Avon. It's part of how we broke up what Avon was. I personally would like to see something like what happens in other areas of the country, where we have a metropolitan county.
Oh no, a metropolitan George.
No, not a metropolitan George, a metropolitan body,
okay.
Strategic council of all of the councils involved to deal with infrastructural matters like transport.
You've got that. You've got the LEP.
The LEP is a completely different thing.
The local enterprise partnership. Yeah, but they get huge amounts of money to spend on all these sorts of things, big joint roads projects. And well, they have the same. You know, they have same.
They also build schools. A part of the LEP is now this Bristol is to do with, I can't remember the name of it, the Bristol Land Board or something, which is supposed to be managing the council. Bristol City Council's owned land. So that would be interesting to see how that goes. And one thing I would say about that is it would be nice if they would just open their LEP meetings to the public, because they are dealing with public land and they're making decisions which should be transparent. Anyway, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers on the housing thing. Everybody wants the housing. How are we going to get the housing? Social housing is desperately
Has finally come around to everybody. Everybody's in favour of it, but of course they should have been in favour of it all along. I mean, this is
Mind being in favour of it. How is it going to happen?
At the moment, Councillor Ron Stone on the council here in Bristol is proposing that we should take over empty properties in the centre of town and use the pension funds of the council's workers to capitalise the possibility of building social housing in the centre of the city in fairly prominent locations and properties that are currently empty. And apparently Manchester City Council have already done this, and it was discussed with George Ferguson during the election campaign.
I think the question about using the pension to do it is a separate matter, but yes.
But in actual fact, of course, central government has forbidden local councils to build council houses for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is the root cause of the problem.
Yes, it is.
And the biggest builder of council houses was, in fact, a Conservative government under Harold Macmillan. And Conservatives used to be very much in favour of it. Mm. Because we're now reaping the whirlwind of not building social housing because we've got a property bubble. So people who want to buy can't get on the ladder because prices are rising.
Property-owning democracy of Thatcher, wasn't it? Selling your council house.
Well, you don't pay capital gains tax on it.
Finally, on this housing one, Ben, can you just tell us what lessons should we be learning up in Filton from Bradley Stoke?
Infrastructure for one. But when I say infrastructure, that does come with a caveat, because the problem is, and I'm going to probably move the debate in a route that I shouldn't, but we are currently dealing with internal EU immigration, which we cannot plan. We don't even know it's going to happen. So we can try and plan out our infrastructure, our schools, our hospitals and all our social housing. But the thing is, we never know who is going to come and who isn't going to come. And that puts us in a very difficult position. Which is actually true, but the people that leave is actually quite a small percentage. But the thing is now, if you look at the schools, for instance, to go back to them, you know, in South Gloucestershire again, you know, many of the schools are having to have two porter cabins in their playgrounds to take in new children for the forthcoming terms, and that's not right.
Okay, well, let's just leave it at that, because this week we had the comeback of one of Britain's greatest ever prime ministers. I'm talking, of course, of Tony Blair. Rather than play his speech in full, The Guardian have got what they call a mashup of his speech, and here it is. This is what Tony Blair really was saying, if you read between the lines of his speech on Wednesday.
It's unsurprising that public opinion in the UK and elsewhere resents me. I would say lies, and I do so because, and this is true, what we did in Iraq or Afghanistan is without doubt a prime proximate cause of the region's chaos. We changed the regimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, put soldiers on the ground, and we're now bemused and bewildered that it's not turned out quite how we expected. However, for the purposes of this speech, despite all the evidence, I completely understand how to achieve the goals of peaceful coexistence around the world. So, in this speech, I will set out a lie that distorts and warps the possibility of peace. But I hope you'll forgive that, because, unfortunately, I'm not going to disappear anytime soon.
Tony Blair there as mashed up by I think he was called Cassette King or Cassette something anyway on The Guardian. But to take us take the point just slightly more seriously, Jason Budd, what do you think? I mean, is there any real credibility left in Tony Blair when he comes out and makes a speech about the Middle East and Islamic extremism for Bloomberg?
Questions of credibility, that's around Tony Blair, that's a big question, isn't it? What is Tony Blair's role in the world? I think is that what he's trying to find. He's a prime minister who feels that he was out of office while still in his prime and is trying to find his role within that. I think he is someone who should still be listened to because he has been a leader of a major world economy. Things that he did can inform people's opinion of what he says. And I think the chap who made that mashup, I want to buy a drink.
Okay. Ben, what are your thoughts about Blair and his legacy and his credibility, I suppose?
Well, credibility none. As far as I'm concerned, he is a war criminal. He should be appearing in The Hague sometime soon. I'm ex-Royal Navy, and I was sent off to do his bidding. I was never too happy about that, but you've kind of got to do it. But the fact is, he took us into an illegal war, you know, for his own reasons. He was disingenuous about how he did that too. And I think he should answer. He should answer for actually undertaking that and doing it. I have no time for the bloke at all, although I'm sure he's not bothered, you know, with all the millions that he has in the bank now.
Martin Summers, were you listening to what Tony Blair had to say? Were you taking him seriously? Because I just find it amazing that people are expected to take the guy seriously. He just doesn't seem to have a lot of fans
these
days.
What I found rather odd is he said at one stage, we'll have to get together with Russia and China to fight Islamic extremism, apart from in Syria, where we're arming the extremists to get rid of Assad.
Yeah.
And it's like, you suddenly realise you've lost the plot a long time ago. Mm. And, of course, he is a war criminal. And I say that he's still a member of the Labour Party, though.
Yeah, sure. And I would say that it's an old quote from the Tory whips that no one ever leaves Number 10 sane.
No. And I think he's, in particular, he is... I mean, he's part of our history, and we're going to have to come to terms with
exactly.
it. But, I mean, he's pushing us now to go to war with Syria.
Yeah.
And that's all wrong. General Michael Rose, who was UN commander in Bosnia, and I was an aid worker out there, because after we didn't attack Syria, three former heads of the British Army all spoke up and said that was the right decision. Mm. So that was Dannett, mm-hmm. Jackson, and Michael Rose. And Michael Rose went further and said, this guy's a serial fire starter. Why do anybody listen to him at all?
Mm.
And I think Tory backbench MPs should listen to the former leaders of the British Army there.
I agree, and I think what recently happened in Parliament over the vote over Syria was an example of perhaps the Labour Party struggling with the legacy of what Labour left, what Blair left them.
They managed to get it right, more by good luck than good management.
Okay,
exactly.
Sticking with the top politicians, David Cameron's constituency office calls the police on the food bank campaigners. The Bishop of Oxford and the Reverend Keith Hebden turned up at David Cameron's constituency office this week on Tuesday, only to find that the police were there. Their letter, which was they were attempting to hand in on food poverty, was part of the End Hunger Fast campaign. It was signed by 42 Anglican bishops and more than 600 clerics, and called on the three party leaders to work with the parliamentary inquiry into food poverty to implement its recommendations. However, despite Cameron's Witney office expecting the visit, they were barred from presenting the letter and instead greeted by police officers. Around 40 people had walked to his office following a church service, and whilst the congregation stood on the opposite side of the road, the Right Reverend John Pritchard and Reverend Hebden went to deliver the letter on their own. The police weren't there very long. When they realised the situation, Reverend Keith Hebden told the Independent, saying they could see Cameron's office staff looking out of the window and they were forced to abandon their visit. Now, this does sound a little bit extreme to call the police. Ben Walker, your UKIP councillor up in Bradley Stoke. What do you make of this little incident?
Yes, it's a little bit shocking, isn't it, really? It's I guess, kind of part of the process, part of democracy, you know. They're playing the game and they're sort of greeted by police. It's quite incredible. Couple of things, really. I'm pleased to see the church stepping up. I think this is what the church should be doing, stuff like this, and I'm glad that they've kind of started to take the lead on this and starting to get involved. You know, I guess they're always worried about sort of getting involved in politics, but this is different. This is about hardship and poverty and actually giving people a voice who perhaps didn't have one before. So I think that's great. with that, I guess Dave was just a bit surprised that they kind of, you know, they stopped, tended to their turnips, and they decided to march on his office. So he was probably a little bit shocked and had to get the heavies out.
Jason, were you thinking that maybe the police thought that they were going to be throwing punches from the congregation,
police...
that maybe the Bishop of Oxford was, you know, looking to do a bit
you
of
don't
boxing?
Know what the, you don't know what information the police had if they were suddenly told that they... you know, if they got a 999 call to say that there was a 600 people heading down the street to them, then I think the police have a duty to respond. They sound as if they've responded quite reasonably.
Well,
actually,
according to the article, anyway, they were they'd arranged to come and deliver the petition
and
beforehand.
And that's a breakdown in the constituency office and their behaviour, not the police's, I think, actually, because they should have greeted them and thanked them for their involvement and their concern and care. And that's where the issue really is. I agree that it's fantastic that the church seems to have woken up to some of these matters, if I can put it that way. I'm not a man of faith myself, but what the Archbishop of Canterbury recently discussed the idea of doing in terms of using the church's assets to out market Wonga and things like that exploit the poor, I think is a good use of the free market for social purposes, and is an example of where you can use morality to do that. Unfortunately, it did turn out that the church also profited.
Okay, final story this week. The police crime figures whistleblower faces dismissal. This is a police whistleblower who exposed the manipulation of crime figures. Has been put on a public register of disgraced officers, Channel 4 News can reveal. Metropolitan Police have accused James Patrick of gross misconduct because he appeared on a TV and radio program to talk about senior officers' treatment of him without getting their permission first. Let's start with you, Ben, on this one.
It's always really worrying when you hear about people who just want to try and step forward and actually, you know, announce that something is wrong and something's being manipulated or not being told the truth about. And we have a very strange attitude towards people who are willing to do that in this country. I don't know quite how you're going to change that. But, you know, this, for me, I think the police do it all the time. Councils do it. We've already talked about that. The government do it all the time. You know, with figures, they manipulate them and they do change them for their own reasons.
Jason, what are your thoughts about this? See, I'm pretty shocked to see someone who's explaining for the public what is being done on the public's behalf with public statistics is being supposedly disgraced.
I'm concerned and shocked by it in the same way that you say, and I think the phrase that is often used about these things is whistleblowers and the need for protection for whistleblowers and the need to protect people who wish to raise genuine debate. It seems like the rules here are being used to penalise him for speaking when he's not said anything that's unreasonable.
Martin?
Well, my uncle used to be a police officer, and I think the main problem is that it's payment by results. People play, you know, basically they're being told they've got to reach a certain target, otherwise they don't get their money, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the police should be, when they're doing their job properly, nothing much happens.
Well, you do wonder with the anti-terrorism budget, you know, if they can't find enough terrorists, they've got to go out and make terrorists almost in order to get their money coming in. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guests. That was UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke Town Council, Ben Walker, and Bristol's only Independence for Bristol councillor, King's Weston, Jason Budd. After the Murdoch News, firebombs attacks, but what the anarchists have to say about it.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a large number of people are responding to the FBI's appeal for information about an American teacher who abused up to 60 pupils at a London school. William Vahe killed himself after investigators began to uncover the scale of his crimes. The convicted paedophile, who worked for 4 years at Southbank International School, also worked around the world. Caroline Corey's son was in his class in Venezuela.
He felt that he was safe and that he had not personally been molested, but he was shaken to the core. I used to go and sit in class with Bill. He was a friend of mine. I realized that he wasn't just grooming the kids. He was grooming us as parents to trust him.
Five world leaders, including David Cameron, have agreed they'll need to discuss increased sanctions against